This is Roger Tuft, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 12th of April, 2011. Roger Tuft, Part 1.
I don't know when I may, if I ever made a decision about specifically going to the Antarctic, but I grew up being aware of Scott and Amazon, mainly through tales of my father, who, although he was a labourer, was very well read. And he was interested in particular in the polar regions. And when I finished my national service, I finished sometime in the early autumn, and I had nowhere specific where I wanted to go. I'd been to university and had an honours degree, but I didn't fancy most of the things that were around. Not that I was offered many. And the nearest I got to that was an interview with an economist in the National Coal Board, which at that time they had various people who would allocate suggestions. And whilst I was waiting to have an interview, which was very relaxed, I might say, I saw this advert in the Times. In the last months of my army career, if you could call it that,
First of all, you're welcome to speak up. It's fine. Please speak up. Don't whisper.
Did you want to hear me?
Yes, speak up. That's fine.
Right.
Yeah.
I was offered a chance as an economist with the National Coal Board, and I heard nothing for that. And I'm in the habit of going to the paper in the morning and buying a Daily Times, and it was completely unsuccessful. And then out of the blue came an offer from the National Coal Board saying if I was interested, come for an interview. And I did that, and blow me, no sooner did that happen than I got a letter from the Crown agents for the colonies, as they were in there. So I had two offers all at once. And finally, the coal board made up their mind and said, you can have the job. This put me in a particularly invidious position because I didn't really want the job. But however, I wrote to the coal board and they said, by all means, go. And I think they thought it was a bit mad, having an idea of going. They didn't know anything. The person interviewing me didn't know anything about it, I might say. Anyhow, then there were further delays in the Shackleton. The ship, the Shackleton, got its anchor jammed. And so I came out of the army at the end of August, and I was finally sailing from the UK on Boxing Day, I think it was.
What year was this, Roger?
That was, well, I was 21 last...
1953?
Yeah.
Can I take you back a little bit before we get to that point? What did you study at school? What were your special subjects at school?
Well, in the old-fashioned days, our headmaster was a great believer in getting basic subjects. So, and four subjects were considered you were doing very well for A-level. I got history and English, economics, and what was that? Economics, history, I'll remember as soon as
you took, you took two of those subjects on to Aberystwyth University, is that right?
Yes, yes.
With literature.
With literature. Yeah.
So what were you thinking of becoming at that point? What was your intended
I had an interest in trees, and I knew that the Forestry Commission, which was nationalised then, they were... it was assumed that they had economists there plotting what they were doing next. But I went to see them as a result of my previous interview. And nobody seemed to know anything. And I said, in desperation almost, well, you must have somebody who makes the economic decisions about trees. And he said, oh, no, as it comes along, we go and buy some more, or we saw something. And it was completely laid back, a complete waste of time. Anyhow, we got to Admiralty Bay in the early New Year. And that year, the base had delivered a new hat, which was prefabricated. So it was a question of... we spent the... There were four of us, I think, was it six? Four. We spent the whole year building the hat, basically.
At Admiralty Bay?
At Admiralty Bay, yeah.
According to my notes, this would be 1956, is that correct?
That would be about right, yes.
Yeah.
It wasn't a particularly happy year.
Why was that?
Well, I don't know. Did you know there was a drowning there?
No, I didn't.
Yeah.
Can you tell me the story?
Yeah. It was the last trip of the season. It was the standard procedure for the ships that were going back to the UK. They had a sort of farewell party on the Shackleton, and then sailed away that night. And of course, inevitably, there was too much to drink. And the whole of the clientele, that's not the right word. The whole of the base members, they had to go to the back to the base, which was about, I think it's about 300 yards maybe to the shore. It wasn't, and it was a clear night, everything okay. And one of them, I assume he's probably dead now anyhow.
Who was it?
Eric Broom. He was a big chap. And he was fussing about getting into the boat and messing about, and various people were talking and nobody in command, as it were. And the boat capsized. And Ron Napier, who was the bit... He was the base leader, I suppose. Ron went overboard and was never seen again. And... I think Arthur Shewry took his place as the commander and basically. But anyhow, we have very little time because, as I say, you had to get the hat, at least the roof on as best you could. And it was also a mild winter. And the result was the sea ice didn't form, not form enough to sledge on. And as I say, everybody's heart was out of it, really. When the ship was coming down again the following summer, I applied to go to Hope Bay, and that's how I got it.
Why do you think, apart from the death of Ron Napier, why do you think Admiralty Bay was not a happy base? Was there something missing?
I think there was, yeah. I think... You felt locked in to some extent. There have been two, was it two fatal accidents? There was Ron, and there was some dude sledged on the ice cap, and he just died, apparently. And there was another one, that was later. So I think it's difficult to quantify, but I think there's much more variety in Hope Bay for us. For us at Admiralty Bay that year, you were just putting wood together. It was pretty dull procedure.
We were just building the hut, basically.
Building the hut.
So there were no trips out?
None at all. There's nowhere to go.
No. Did you have dogs at Admiralty Bay?
We had one.
Oh, right. So there's a lack of dogs as well.
There's a lack of dogs, yeah. It did intermittently over its history, apparently. It had dogs and then they farmed them out to one of the other bases and then came back and so on. So I don't know what happened after we went, but I think it was just meteorology that they were doing. But as I say, it was not happening.
Do you sense that you've worked on a base with dogs and a base with no dogs? Admiralty Bay and then Hope Bay, which had its own huskies. Do you sense a difference in the mood of those two types of bases?
I think so. I never went on any other base, so I couldn't sort of generalise really, but one of the things about Hope Bay, because of its position, the arm of the peninsula, it was like having a can opener. You could go down the coast and get away. And there was Hope Bay, which was just 20 miles. Everybody used to like to go there because it was a good stretch run. And you got away from what was going on in the base. But I can honestly say there was a certain amount of quarrels. But there was never anything that I would deem compared to what happened at my house.
Let's go back to the beginning a bit, if we might, Roger. You were born in Newport in Gwent in 1932.
Yeah.
And you went to Aberystwyth University.
Yeah.
But at some point in that time, you must have become aware of the Antarctic. What was the first inkling you had that such a place existed?
Well, I can't say I knew it from the moment I was born.
No.
I was saying my father was a great reader. And I got from him about Scott and what happened and so on. So it was a slow process, I suppose you might say. But by the time, until I came across this advert after I left the forces in not doing national service, until I came across that advert, I honestly didn't have a clue that there were people down there who were meteorologists or surveyors or what.
What was your national service like, Roger?
Well, it was... I don't know whether I should say this, but I quite enjoyed it. I was in the airborne, and we were transferred to the Suez Canal then. We were patrolling. So we had a job to do, you might say. We only worked half the day, and then everybody was sunbathing in the afternoon.
You were in the parachute? Parachutes, weren't you?
Yeah.
And the Suez Crisis was a couple of years old by the time you got there.
There was a Suez Crisis just as we got into... I remember having an argument with Hugh about this.
Hugh Simpson.
Because I said the Suez Crisis was a waste of time and served no purpose. And Hugh disagreed with me. So we were obviously both at Hope Bay at that time. As I say, it was something which impinged. It was something we followed out of curiosity, but had no real... which is interesting, because I think my group were called up at the time of that crisis. So had it been a bit later or a bit earlier, there's a good chance I would never got to the Antarctic. And yeah.
Did you see any action in Suez as such?
No. Well, when I say action, we were at a big camp, and it was when the crisis was rising. There were a number of occasions when, from on the British camps along the Suez Canal, people took a shot at them, and one or two were killed in that way, but there was never anything.
Snipers, you mean?
Snipers, yeah.
And you jumped? Did you make jumps?
Yes, and we jumped. We jumped at night as practice because they hadn't done anything in the UK. I quite like jumps because you get an adrenaline fix.
So when you went for your interview with Fitz, do you think that service in the Suez area helped you get the job?
Yes, I do. There were quite a few parachutists in Fitz. In fact, one of the lads who was in Fitz, just down the road from us. The ship came in when we was unloading some of the food supply, and suddenly a voice said, and I was helping these crates or what have you, suddenly a voice said, "Bombardier Tuft, I presume." And it was one of the lads who'd been with me in the army, and quite independently we'd got into that situation. But going back to the sledging was, by and large, fairly straightforward. We didn't go into any of the... We stayed on the sea ice, which was safer, actually.
This is at Hope Bay.
At Hope Bay, yeah.
Yeah. Tell me about some of your colleagues at Hope Bay. Who was with you?
Well, it was Sam Blake I was talking about, who was it was Harry Dangerfield. He was the radio operator. He was a great guy. He had a very funny sense of humour, a broad sense of humour. And he was wont to produce spurious wireless information.
How do you mean, Roger?
Well, he'd say there's a SOS come in, the Shackleton sank or something. This was at the time. I think the Shackleton sank after that.
So what was he doing? Because it was Hope Bay the centre for the radio communication at that point.
Well, I wouldn't say it was the centre, but it had the biggest number of operators there. It was the International Geophysical Year by that time. And... Harry was the least likely superman you were ever likely to come across. He was short, he was thin, he wore thick glasses, and the whole thing about him, you'd say, but he was excellent as a wireless operator.
So how did he wind people up? He went on air and...
He had the Radio Shack, which in fact was part of the main shack, but it had this appendage stuck on. He had the schedule messages used to come through in Morse or occasionally in code, and Harry just took them down, and the rest of us didn't know what they were, of course. But he would come up with something completely outrageous.
Right, so he would tell you personally.
Today, yeah.
He wasn't broadcasting these fake messages.
That's right.
He was just mentioning them on base.
Yeah.
Oh, I see, okay.
Yeah.
Hugh Simpson was with you, wasn't he, as well?
Hugh, yes.
And you were helping Hugh with some of his experiments.
That's right.
Tell me about that, please.
I don't know which ones he was usually doing at that time.
It doesn't matter. Over the period you were with Hugh.
Well... It was eosinophils, wasn't it? Anyhow, he was he was measuring stress by and large, and he had two periods. One was stress over a period, and then there was the biorhythms, which was stress over a shorter period, over 24 hours, shall we say. And he used this to see whether... he could make the... any...
correlation?
Correlation would be a word, yes.
You were his guinea pig?
I was his guinea pig, but I got my revenge by taking his blood from time to time.
Tell me about what you had to do to be a guinea pig and what he did to you.
Well, basically...
Urine samples.
Urine samples was one, that was easy. He took, I don't know...
fine manipulative skills, putting ball bearings
into... Yeah, that was a later one. There were two or three... when I went to Spitsbergen with you later, I did a whole lot of the same sort of thing. I can remember one of the chaps looking over his shoulder at Hope Bay and seeing what he was doing, and this chap said, "It looks like pretty esoteric stuff to me."
Blood samples.
There was blood. You didn't take all that much blood, if I recollect.
So in order to test your biorhythms, he was taking blood and urine. Was there any other experiment he was doing on you?
He did. Think.
If he's not going to come, don't worry about it, Roger.
No, he's not coming. Anyhow, we went. I did one trip with you down the coast, and we were manhauling then. So that was obviously something stress related. That was one of the series he took. He lost one set of a lot of his stuff when we had this big blowout on Victory Glacier. That was later on. And
when you say his stuff, do you mean his experimental?
His experimental stuff.
It was blown away, was it?
Well, the Victory Glacier was discovered, if that's the right word, in the week of Victory in Europe, and he got the name. It's a very prominent glacier. And it was also renowned for being very, very windy. It used to pile up and come hurtling down onto the tent. And we were camped, we'd been held up by bad weather for ages, and we finally decided to have a go at it, crossing it. We normally kept to the sea, but the sea looked pretty thin, so we thought it was better not to. And we got the tent up and so on. We weren't short of daylight. It was just about 24 hours of daylight, and this was about 10 o'clock. And about getting on to 12 o'clock, the wind was starting to get up, and I was in the tent with Dick Walcott, who was hanging on the wall still next door there, thanks to me, because it was getting a real blow, and I realised it was going to be a real blow. I went outside and I put my windproofs on first, and went outside and tried to put snow on the flaps. But as soon as I put it down, the wind blew it away. And Dick, who was in his sleep, I got a bit pretty cheesed off with it, and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "This bloody tent is going to go any minute." "Oh, you're fussing," he said. His words were hardly out of his mouth. Wham! the pyramid tent, which has four poles, of course, and two of the poles snapped, just went over like that. And I knew it was serious because we had two dog teams, and we always stake them apart at night to stop fights. And the top dog team was blown, the picket was blown out, and they slid down the glacier into the bottom dog's thing. And they all looked absolutely fed up. Normally they would have had a wonderful fight, both teams going for each other. But they just sat miserable. And came when the morning came, it was a bit like a battlefield. Hugh lost an awful lot of his films, and he lost his notes and things. And I said, I'll go down the glacier and see if I can pick up anything that's worth saving. So there was myself and Hugh and Dick Walcott and Lee Royce. And we got the... I got down to near the foot of the glacier as far as I dared go with the crevasses. And there wasn't much I could pick up, actually. But I there were three boots, and Hugh had some rather posh climbing boots. And when I came up to the others who managed to resurrect the tent, I said, oh, there were three boots down there, but one was obviously no good, so I threw it away. But of course, I'd left two odd ones.
Did he ever get to Viewpoint Hut?
Yes.
What was it like?
It was smashing. Everybody liked it. It was tiny. And it was, you could warm it up in no time. And it had a good supply of seal for the dog. It was always regarded as something of the day out.
It was like a holiday chalet, was it?
Absolutely, yeah.
Did it serve any practical purpose as well?
Only if you got caught out in bad weather, you had to be careful about making a run across the bay. Just before I came down to Viewpoint. I don't know whether it was somebody tried to get back home, which was fatal, instead of pitching camp. And the whole team went down and they lost the whole lot.
The dogs, you mean?
The dogs, yeah. And the sledge. The sledge lowered a lot. It was right near the tide crack, which is always a dangerous point. And it shouldn't have happened, actually. But there you are. People, when there's only... Sometimes you get so near and yet so far. There was another occasion, completely different in many respects. One of the factors of the high winds in Hope Bay and the area, the saving grace of them, they used to come down off the plateau, gathering speed, but they also gathered temperature. And by the time they hit the sea ice, often you could literally see the snow going down. And I was on Ross Island on one occasion. There were two of us, including Mike Ruby, the dog man. And we were stuck on the island, and we couldn't do anything because it was all, we just had to wait for it to freeze. Well, just trying to stop this, as I say, they built Viewpoint, which was very basic, but people liked it.
Did you spend the night there on occasions?
Yes, yeah.
In the hut?
In the hut, yeah. There was generally a certain amount of fruit and stuff left behind, but people were willing to put up with the discomfort. What I was going to say about that particular occasion was the temperature shot up and the wind swung round and it was running parallel to... We were about 10 to 15 miles from Viewpoint, and it started to go, and it literally scoured the snow off the ice. And it got so that we couldn't stand, not because the ice was so thin, but simply because the wind had smoothed it, chiseled it. And there was Mike Ruby and myself, and I think there were about four dogs or six. And as soon as we got up, we were only about 5 or 10 miles away. As soon as we got up, the wind blew you off your feet. And it's going in. And we literally crawled along for a lot of this. And in the end, Mike had the idea, which we should have thought at the beginning. He said, let's let the dogs off and it'll be easier. And it was, because he followed us obediently. And although we fell over a lot, it was nothing like as bad as what had happened when we first got onto it.
So the dogs raced back to base, did they?
Yeah, they raced back to base. They were all waiting when we got there.
Did you let them off one by one or as a group?
As a group.
So they were still tied together?
They were let off as a group, but they were individual dogs when they left their lead.
Right. So they weren't still spanned together. They were free to go. Yeah. Because I think the drowning of the team of dogs that you talked about at Hope Bay was when they escaped but still spanned together, still traced together. So when they went over the edge into the water...
Was that at Hope Bay?
Yes, I think it was. I think so.
I think there were... I wasn't there when the team went in, but I know one or two people obviously didn't want to get involved in what happened. I think... Oh, it's impossible to say because I wasn't there.
This was Julian Taylor and Alan Precious, I think, that's right. I remember the story. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. We're darting about a bit, but that's fine. Let me ask you about one or two more of your colleagues. There's a chap called Fritz Körner.
Körner.
Tell me about him. He was memorable, wasn't he?
He was an oddball, yeah. And I was saying to you earlier, I think he must be dead, but I got an obit of him in The Guardian recently. Well, it was not an obit. But anyhow, Fritz was a funny chap, and he was a long, wiry chap. He had a long, wiry nose. And he was a great runner. And this was in the days of Chataway and people. And he used to race against them. But he had... He was never in the top grade. He was never sufficiently interested. But he came down on Fitz to do... I don't know whether he had made up his mind before he came down or what, but he did meet. He was a Met observer, and he did Met. But he also... There were one or two minor glasses around, and he took measurements on snow accumulation. And... when he got back, there was a Berea base of Fritz in Birmingham University at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Fritz, he worked up his figures and finally got them, and he got something out of it. Well, he got a PhD. But he was very hard. He was a very strong runner, and he liked to... How can I put it? He liked to be organised for the purposes of his running or going from A to B, but he wasn't particularly worried otherwise. Whereas Don McCallman, who was a Glaswegian, a Glasgow mathematician, Don, as a matter of principle, insisted on the logistics of any sledge he was on as being correct. So he wanted to know at any time. We had 10-man boxes, was the normal method of transiting the human food. And occasionally his path crossed with Fritz. And on this particular occasion, this was in the summer, and they were digging a pit. And it was, Fritz had already got stuck in this pit. He went down too far and couldn't get out. And
he dug himself too far down.
Yeah, and we weren't particularly worried because we knew he was around. But anyhow, he finally got himself out, and he had spiky hair and a long, thin nose. And I was camping nearby, I can't remember why, and I heard a noise or something, and I looked out, and there was Fritz appearing over the horizon with his frost all over. And this was a famous occasion when he was sharing a tent with Don, and Don always could tell you exactly how much sugar you had left. It's out of the little cubes. And I don't suppose there's one chap on Fidge that ever bothered to count, but they more or less sort of like putting salt on, they put the sugar cubes on. And if they ran out a few days early, well, tough, nobody was worried. But not so Don. Don wanted to know. And it became particularly complicated when there was bad weather, because it was a terrible tendency to pass the time and drink or eat more than you're supposed to. On this occasion, Fritz was going to put some sugar cubes in the cocoa, and Don said to him, "I hope you realise if you put an extra cocoa in now, you'll have to take one out later on today." Whereupon Fritz exploded and tipped the remains of the box in and said, "Oh, for God's sake, Don, use the whole lot up in one go." But he could see the funny, you could see the funny side of it. That was a saving grace with Fritz, because he could be very rude, but he was also very funny.
Was he German?
Somewhere along the line, yeah.
There was another practical joke he played as well, in an upside down position.
That was
another. Tell me about that, Roger.
Well, we had a relationship with the Argentinians down the road, down the coast. And they used to like to come up and moan to us on a Saturday night often. It was their night out. And they had various English films in English in their hat, but they came up to us often to watch them. And these films, they were years old. 1930, so they were absolute rubbish. But we used to get them. And then Fritz's piece, there was these songs. When we saw them coming, we could see them coming. They were about a mile or 2 miles. We were all busy ourselves, because very often by and large, an unhappy lot, the Argentinians. They didn't take to it well, what they were doing. I think they were all people in the army. They weren't interested. Anyhow, Fritz's way was, he had these big Mickey Mouse boots with great big ends, and he'd wait until they arrived, and then there was this rod hanging across the door, just inside the sledge door, and he'd hang upside down and just do or say nothing. He'd just be there. So they got the message, but at first I think they thought we were slightly mad, didn't they?
But it was worth seeing the Argentinians' faces, was it?
It was, yeah.
You also shared some time with Wally Herbert, who became quite famous, didn't he?
Yeah.
What do you make of Wally?
Well, I think I can declare an interest here, because I had a quarrel with Wally, and I don't know whether you know about his trip to the North Pole and that he'd planned.
Tell me about it.
Well, I had sledged with Wally. Was a surveyor in the army, and then he came down on Fidge, more or less, I think it was the same time as I did, exactly the same time. And he was never happy to do. He wanted to do something more spectacular, not, whereas most of us were really about, you could say. Wally wanted to do something more spectacular, and he planned this polar trip across the North Pole, starting in the Bering Straits, over the top and down the end. And I'd sledge with him in the Antarctic, as I say. I wasn't particularly keen on this. I didn't like the idea. For a start, it was a hell of a long journey, and you couldn't do it possibly without aircraft. And I thought, once you have crew aircraft coming in, you know, and you've got to get the fuel and there's all the other things have got to be fitted in. It was becoming, to me, a trip which was losing its shape completely. Mm. I think it would have been far better to do a shorter. I thought it would be better to do a shorter trip, and like Tillman did. Tillman did in his old age. Did quite a few quite good films. He did Across the Crozet Islands, the first one. He crossed Andes Ice Cap. He climbed some Mount Raleigh in Baffin Island.
And did you express to Wally Herbert your doubts about his plans?
I did, yes.
What was his reaction?
It's very difficult because I really, looking back, I should have made my point clear. Most of the time, well, one of the times, I had no money, basically, other than what I earned on my feet. And I was saying to her, this went on over a period of years when we started. And I tried to impress on Wally that I had to have some income from somewhere, and I couldn't do anything. And he kept prevaricating. And we didn't get anywhere, and he sort of just closed it up. And then we did this, we had this reconnaissance trip, so-called, which was from Thule in northern Greenland to Devon Island. And we were doing this trip. Now, to me, and I was with Alan Gill, to me, the trip should have been used to get used to the dogs, and we run in a different way in the north and on Fids. They're a fan trace, you know. And with that year, thanks, the easy part is there's a map on that. I was looking at when you came in, there's a map on that new book. The easy part was over Ellesmere Island. There's a little call, but it's not so little. It's about 10 miles, and it's about 3,000 or more feet. And you have to go over that. Otherwise, you go round. It's just not feasible. And this particular year, and for, as far as I know, it's probably happened in the past, there was no snow. It was just wood, wood runners. And we had to resort to a mixture of man-hauling, shooting some dogs, carrying it ourselves, and what should have been, and the other people, including the Swedes who have used it, they speak of just sort of sailing over the top. Rather, you might think of going into town. Meanwhile, there was no money coming in, and we needed money. We needed something for the dogs from Seelmy. And one thing and another, and I told him. And in the end, I said to Wally, I'm not prepared to go on like this. I don't think it's the sort of trip I want to be on. And that was then. And
so what was it in Wally's personality that caused the problem then, would you say?
Well, being, I suppose it'd be a bit of crude psychology, but Wally, to me, was at his best when I first knew him. He was very similar to me. We'd both been in the army for the length of the time. We both quite liked what we were doing at the time. We got on all right. And this trip of his became an obsession. And
an irrational obsession?
Am I on there? No, I suppose it wasn't anti-rational. If he'd been doing it about 50 or 100 years later, before rather, it would have been one of the great polar expeditions that had never come back. So we got I left, I split up then. he went on, to my surprise, I might say. I didn't think he'd get the money, but he obviously he managed to soft soap the right number of people. And Alan Gill, who was on the trip with me, always used to say, "Wally would be marvellous to have on an expedition as long as you didn't expect him to do anything." So he did get his transporter, but then he suffered the great disappointment of everybody saying, "So what? He missed his boat."
Let's go back to time at Hope Bay then, and your memories of working in that base. You had the opportunity to complain about things at the end of each season, didn't you? There was a complaint system.
Yeah, it's a bit of a joke.
Was it?
Yeah.
Why was this a joke, Roger?
Yes, you should do. Somewhere in the files of the India office or somewhere, somebody's got a pile of our reports. There's supposed to be a report on food, on fuel, on everything, just about. But when, I've forgotten who it was, but somebody went, I think it was, when somebody went, the Crown, it was the Crown thingy of the colonies. It was the manager, Crown agents, was it?
Yes.
When somebody went to see when I was there and complained about, we had a season when, for some reason or another, I don't know what the reason was, our sledges were rubbish. They were cracking and splintering. And somebody, when they got back to the UK, one of the people went and complained to them and said it wasn't good enough because it could be dangerous. I mean, if your sledge cracked up and you didn't have anything to carry your stuff on, you could be in quite...
Why were they cracking up?
Well, it's a peculiar. The base of the runner was just snapping. I could put it across my knee and just snap it. And I was talking to a Mel, somebody later when I'm back home, and they said it had probably dried too much, the wood in the kiln. So we had this complaint, as I say, and it went on, but nobody took any notice. But they were fairly minor. I mean, the food was, I never worried me the food. I thought it was quite good. It was basic, it was quite good. You use seal, you use penguin.
So the problem with the food, if I read this correctly, is that it simply wasn't varied enough.
Yes, it wasn't varied.
What were you stuck with? What was the diet like?
Well, we had penguin when it was there, penguin eggs when it was there. We had dried eggs. We had sugar. We had dried fruit of different sorts, dried bananas. What else? Made bread. Everybody made bread. Plenty of butter, plenty of margarine, currants. I never felt that I was deprived at all. Chocolate bars.
How about keeping yourself occupied during the long winter nights? What were your favourite pastimes?
Reading.
Reading?
Reading. Or sitting around the fire and talking about which dog was better than the other.
Did you discuss your predecessors?
Not to any real extent, I don't think. No.
Scott, Shackleton and so on.
Oh, there wasn't a great deal to discuss, but most of us thought Scott was a bit of a clot, and there was nothing to discuss about it. We did quite a bit of photography, you know, black and white stuff. We bought the materials for that. If you're somebody like Mike, he used to take, Mike Ruby used to take dogs on maniacal. Mike was the oddball. And he'd take some. He'd say, you'd be going to 11:45, and you think, oh, I'd better get to bed. And Mike would appear and say, fancy a run? I'll just harness the dogs up. And he'd run the dogs a few miles.
How were the facilities at Hope Bay? Were they tolerable, or were you in fairly rudimentary?
I would say they were tolerable. Again, we had plenty of water as long as we were prepared
to dig it out.
Yeah.
How did you have a bath?
Well, it was a diesel drum, which was split horizontally, and they bolted together. And if you had your turn came around, when it was your turn, the bath was yours, and you could heat it. There's a little boiler under it, and you could heat it as hot as you liked, or you could just leave it cold. But the only rule was you had to leave it the way you'd found it. So if you filled up the drum with boiling hot water, by the time you'd had your bath, when the chap came the next day, he expected to find that full of, it was on a rotation. So,
did everybody always stick to the rules?
Oh, yeah. We were law-abiding lot. There might be a insurer there, but it was funny because it was, in that sense, it was a pure democracy, and people didn't need force because they couldn't stand the ridicule if somebody was caught pinching snow or there'd be something hurled at them.
So there was a rigid pattern to the bath night routine, and you couldn't have a bath any time you liked?
No, unless you did it with, unless you had a discussion with A, who didn't want it.
Oh, you could swap?
You could do a swap, yeah.
Okay. Let's talk a bit about the sledging then, if we can, Roger. One of the trips you did was to go right round James Ross Island. Now, was that with a purpose, or was that just a jollification?
Well, it was like most of what happened at Hope Bay. It was both, I would say. That was where Hugh was doing it wasn't the eosinophil. Anyhow, he was taking blood, and we were, there was just myself and Mike with you. And the idea, I don't know whether you know the history of Hope Bay, do you? It was a Swedish ship.
Go on, explain.
Well, early in the 20th century, there was a Swedish chap called Nordenskiöld, and he mounted an expedition and went down the coast and as far as he could into the ice, and then he was going to see what happened from there. And this was in 1902, and his ship, on the way down, the peninsula runs very roughly north. On the way down, he dropped off a party of geologists. Then he went further down and built a hut, which was about as big as a bit short, smaller than this. So you had some geologists, you had the men in the hut. And on the way back now to Stockholm, no wireless, don't forget, on the way back to Stockholm, his ship was pierced by ice and sank. They all got off, but the situation was chaps in Stockholm didn't know where they were. The chaps who had been sunk off the ship didn't know that they knew where they were. The party that was doing the geology, they were stuck because they all knew that something had obviously happened because nobody had come for them. So they had to spend the winter in this well, it was a, what am I going to call it?
Refuge hut.
A refuge hut, sort of. And then in the next summer, the Swedes sent down a ship to see what happened. And the chaps who had been geologising also came down, so you now had this case, all unbeknown to anyone. You had the ship coming from Sweden, you had the ship coming down the coast that was the geologist, you had the ship that was doing some more geology further down. And miraculously, because there was no communication, they all met at the same time. And this, the skipper, can't blame him, was convinced that the ice was going to come back in. And so he wouldn't let them take anything when they met in the hut, other than what they could carry. And they all went off. But beforehand, they shot all the dogs. And it's quite... And the people from the refuge hut, they came out, and that was why it was Hope Bay they'd been there. But the poor dogs had just left, and they were still there. They were mummified along the front. And they then all got off, so there was just one chap who actually died. He had TV. So that was the end of that. So it was a bit, it was that base that Shackleton was coming to when he went to Elephant Island. The tide was taking him. Of course, he had very little control over the boats. But the tide was taking, it goes around like a clockwise in that part of the ocean. And he couldn't get it right, so that if he'd hit it right, he would have been on the land, big chunk. No, but he was taking fast. And he ended up on Elephant Island, so he then had to make his own way.
What did your dogs, when you got to this hut, what did your dogs make of the mummified dogs on the ground?
They didn't seem to be... I don't think to them it was sterile. It had no scent. Okay. I would guess it had no scent.
You read about this expedition, didn't you, back at base? You read the story of the hut.
Oh, yes.
Back at base in his book.
Yeah.
And there was, in the book, there's references to food dumps, which he'd left.
Well, I was going to say to you, actually, there's also, he says in the book, it's funny, I gave the book this year to an old friend of ours, because he was keen. What he says in the book, amongst other things, we were down here at sea level for our hut, and you would go over the top of a col, and you come down to sea level on the other side. Now, when this was a geology party now who were coming down, and they had all these specimens, and they had a whole lot of camera equipment and various quite. And they, when they got to the call, they said, "This is ridiculous taking all this with us. We'll build a depot here and come back for it when we got some more manpower." And they did just that, and then went on to the ship, which had just come in, pure by chance. And there was the ship, and the skipper said, in fact, you know, get lost. If you don't come with me, you're stuck. So they jumped aboard the ship at the easiest opportunity, glad to get the hell out of it. But no one ever bothered to pick up all that stuff. And I offered it as an expedition to all sorts of people, but they won't bite.
So it's still there?
Well, it must be.
100 years later?
Unless there was a landslide.
All right, OK. And finally, on that particular trip, on the way back, you came across this rather sad spectacle of and I've read about this elsewhere, of the Weddell seals dying.
Yeah, it's very sad, that.
Can you tell me about that, Roger?
Well, back... If I can give it, James Ross Island, you can say, is roughly that shape. Here's our hut here. We went down and around and back to the hut. Now, when we were down, this was open sea here. Shackleton was over here. He wasn't there at the time, of course. This was open sea. And when you got on the sledge and... It was dead flat, and you could look for as long as you could look. There was just this ocean, grey and forbidding. and we had to ski all the way down there. That was the chaps with the other bits and pieces that they were coming. So they were all spread all over the Antarctic. And we first, as we went down, it's very roughly, you could say, James Ross, two sides 100 miles an hour each side, and two sides about 40 odd. And we were, one of the things you notice is there's no blizzard, it's a big if, I suppose. But how quiet the Antarctic is, can be absolutely quiet.
When there's no wind.
When there's no wind. And anyhow, we were coming down this side, the long side, and we started hearing this noise, and we couldn't think. As usual, we had no clue about what it could have been. Mm. We knew that it wasn't anywhere down round us. Anyhow, as we got round, we got further down, the edge of the ice had been eroded by the sea, and so there was way in. But on the ice itself, as far as you can see, and I mean as far as you can see, were these seals, dead or dying?
Weddell seals.
And they were dying, and the young were dying, and nobody to feed them, of course. And the others were dying anyhow. I've never seen an explanation. I think somebody went down the following season, but couldn't. There was none there. But
so they were just lying there and
crying for their mothers.
And the adults were expiring.
Yeah.
And there was you had no idea why this was happening?
No, nothing.
Have you read anything about it since?
I think Hugh tried to get something published. I don't think he was very successful. And somebody said, I don't know. It may have been in one of the Fids magazines, somebody put something.
Was it upsetting?
Upsetting. Yes. Very upsetting. Particularly the young ones, because I don't know whether you've heard of a baby seal, it's just like a kid.
Like a child?
Like a child, yeah.
Mm. Sobering spectacle.
It is, yeah. Yeah.
Let's take a break, Roger. We'll come back and do some more. Thank you.